Good morning. May it please the court, Christopher Forrest, 23105, from the law firm of Hamilton, Fox & Waller, representing the appellees Carol Shirley and Linda Turnwall. Also present at council table, Bill Waller and Dylan Metzner, also from my firm. I would like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal, if that's possible.
Sure, that's fine.
Thank you. One of the core issues before the court in this case, and a critical issue guiding the conduct of lawyers in general in Colorado, is whether Rule of Professional Conduct 1.7 governs the analysis of whether a lawyer possesses a conflict of interest in a case such as this. The issue is whether the Katz firm, as serving as lawyer and trustee for two trusts with conflicting interests, was required as a matter of law to recuse itself from the case following the dictates of RPC 1.7. Judge Talman, in the Klarner 1 decision of the Court of Appeals, concluded as a matter of law that the Katz firm had a conflict of interest applying the Rule 1.7 standard. And that opinion very carefully broke out the analysis of the law firm versus the analysis of the lay trustee or son's trustee's duties into two separate sections of the opinion. Judge Talman's prior opinion, in fact, analyzed the conflict of interest of the law firm under RPC 1.7, acknowledging that it's a higher standard of obligation for a lawyer than the lay trustee standard, which is really embodied in Scott's on Trust Section 170.
Mr. Forrest, it's yes. Nice of you to mention my opinion, but it wasn't actually embraced with enthusiasm by the Supreme Court, as you know. More specifically, in that opinion, the division said that there was on the one hand, an inherent conflict of interest, but on the other hand, remanded the case for further consideration as to whether the trustee should be removed. So, didn't that suggest that one alternative or option was not to remove the trustees?
I don't believe that it is when you look at the requirements of RPC 1.7. RPC 1.7 says absolutely clearly that if you have a lawyer with a conflict of interest under Section B, where they are representing two clients simultaneously in the same litigation and they have competing interests, no doubt, two clients, two trusts, Katz firm representing both of them in the same litigation, no doubt that there are competing interests, no doubt that there's a conflict between the trustees. Even Judge Stewart, in her final opinion in 2009, recognized the conflict of interest of the trustees. In that situation, it is the self-executing obligation of the lawyer to withdraw from the case. I don't even think it needs to be analyzed under the 15-1 1401 standard for removal of a trustee, because that statute on its face applies only to lay trustees who are also beneficiaries of the estate and governs the standards of removal of them.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes,
you started out by saying there's a question whether the professional rules of conduct govern this. Didn't the Supreme Court address that issue? They brought it up, did not resolve it actually, but then, as I understood it, when addressing attorney fees, set aside the rationale and said even if there's a conflict of interest, that's not sufficient grounds for removal.
I don't believe that that's what they were saying. What I think they were saying was that the issue, they commented that a petition to remove was not before them, that there had been no evidentiary hearing conducted on the necessity of removing the trustees based on a conflict of interest standard. There had been no prevailing party on that concept. They then applied simply the lower standard of breach of trust, really under the Scott's test, to determine that there was no prevailing party. But in footnote 8, Justice Corliss very carefully carves out the fact that what is not before the court is the standard of conduct of a lawyer under 1.7. That was before the Court of Appeals, and the decision as a matter of law that the lawyers had violated 1.7, thus at least justifying a remand for determination of further remedies, was left undisturbed. Cert was not taken on that piece, and I think it's very clear from that footnote that Justice Corliss understood cert had not been taken on that piece of the case, and intended the commentary in footnote 8 about Rule 1.7 to guide what the court did below.
Mr. Forrest, didn't the Supreme Court suggest that it was necessary that there be a petition for removal filed, removal of the trustees filed, in order to trigger the consideration of Rule 1.7?
Absolutely, and that's what happened on remand.
Was there a formal motion
Yes.
to remove the trustees filed?
Absolutely, and we had a full evidentiary hearing on that motion. The result of that full evidentiary hearing on that motion was that probate court Gene Stewart writing indicated first that the lay trustees under the Scott's interest standard had a clear conflict of interest. Judge Stewart then, I think, made an unprecedented ruling in saying the law firm trustees, who also simultaneously both represent those trusts, the trustees, and have a fiduciary duty flowing to the beneficiaries, had no conflict of interest based purely on the analysis one under Scott's section 170, that they had no direct pecuniary interest in the case. She actually brackets the word lawyer into section 170 and says this applies to lawyers. She never, ever once analyzes the conflict of interest of the lawyers, consistent with footnote 8 of the Supreme Court, or consistent with Klarner 1, under the higher fiduciary standard of a lawyer under RPC 1.7. We believe that that was plain error, and under any standard of review, whether the Court of Appeals opinion, that portion of it was law of the case, and she was required to accept the fact that there was an existing conflict of interest by the lawyer trustees, or whether she was reviewing it purely on a de novo basis because it had been sent down to her for an evidentiary proceeding, and there was a petition to remove filed. We had a multi-hour hearing on it with a comprehensive ruling. She said flat out, the law firm trustees didn't have a conflict because they did a good job. And what she really says, and it highlights the essence of why there was a conflict of interest, is she says they didn't really represent the best interest of either side. They worked to forge some kind of compromise and serve as a buffer between the two sides. I believe as a matter of law under Rule 1.7, once you have conflicted clients, and don't forget, Judge Stewart has already ruled in the same order that the clients are conflicted. The trust is conflicted. The trustees are both beneficiaries of both trusts, and they have a conflicting interest with the other beneficiaries as to the allocation of taxes.
Excuse me, you have about 6.5 minutes left. You asked me to remind you when you had 7 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just try and finish my thought.
Sure.
But once she made a determination that there was in fact a conflict of interest by the trustees, the lay trustees, the case falls apart for the lawyers because the lawyers can't stay in and represent both sides of a conflicted transaction. The requirement that the lawyers withdraw under RPC 1.7 is self-executing, and frankly, they should have withdrawn from the start of the case at a minimum. They should have withdrawn when they sought instructions, and the instructions shouldn't give them a safe harbor, because what they sought when they sought instructions is they advocated a position. Frankly, they've advocated a position all along and made our trust pay half the fees for issues that we have prevailed on. Like, was there a conflict of interest for the lay trustees? Ultimately, we prevailed on that issue. We got to pay our attorney's fees, and we got to pay 47% of the Catsburn's attorney's fees for litigating against us on that issue. Same thing with the issue of allocation of expenses under the trust. We prevailed on that issue in the Court of Appeals, and that issue was not appealed. We got to pay both sides' fees on that. That's a conflict of interest. With that, I will reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Forrest.
May it please the court. My name is Thomas Neville, attorney registration number 35011, here on behalf of the law firm of Katz, Look & Moisen. Somewhere along the line, this case is transformed from a question about the proper interpretation of testamentary documents and federal law into a breach of fiduciary duty case. I think that in order to understand how we got here, we need to review the procedural context or procedural posture briefly for context. And then we'll talk about the three good reasons to affirm the probate court. One, that the Supreme Court impliedly overruled the conflict of interest issue upon which the daughters are relying. Two, the fact that the probate court complied with this court's actual mandate. And three, that there's an exception to the mandate rule that applies where the evidence after an evidentiary hearing is different than it was initially. To put this in context, when Judge Stewart initially reviewed this case, it was in the context of a petition for instructions in which she had to analyze the testamentary documents and federal law. The only reason that this would involve a determination of fact is if those testamentary documents were ambiguous. And ultimately, she concluded that they were not. And so, on that record, this case came to this court. We got to the petition for instruction stage because daughters wanted Marion's trust to carry the full burden of the estate taxes, thereby maximizing what they recovered and minimizing what sons recovered. Given that position, KLM filed a petition for instructions, and then the appeal ensued. The division of this court concluded that the probate court erred by applying the federal law, section 2207A of the Internal Revenue Code, and it granted daughters' motions for attorney's fees. Now, on appeal, the Supreme Court held that the trustees were correct in interpreting the testamentary documents and Colorado and federal law, and it reversed every rationale advanced by daughters in support of the award of attorney's fees. And it is important at this point to note that the issue of the 1.7 conflict was specifically raised by daughters to the Supreme Court. It is the lead issue in their answer brief to the Supreme Court. They lead off with that issue, and the Supreme Court then, in addressing attorney's fees, turns to the last argument. First, that's the fifth argument that they address. Finally, Albert's daughters contend that the trustees had a conflict of interest in administering the QTIP trust. To challenge the propriety of that action, they needed to file a petition to remove, which was not done initially, but was done on remand. And when that petition to remove was heard by the court, there was a full evidentiary hearing. And in that hearing, Judge Stewart concluded that although the sons were nominally trustees, they were largely absent from the litigation prior to this point. That in fact, the law firm trustee was acting as an independent trustee. The other key factual finding here, the other key piece of analysis that Judge Stewart made was that to accept the argument that the representation of two trusts with competing interests requires a conclusion that they're conflicted at law is that argument would require the court to assume that the trustees have affirmatively resisted or should have affirmatively resisted making the contribution from the QTIP trust to Marion's estate to address the tax burden as required by federal tax law. In essence, the position that daughters want this court to adopt is that by following federal law, trustees have breached a fiduciary duty. And that creates an impossible position for a fiduciary to be in, because that then requires a fiduciary to say yes anytime a beneficiary wants anything.
Mr. Neville, let me back you up just a little bit and ask you a couple of questions about Rule 1.7. Did Judge Stewart address Rule 1.7 in her order on remand?
She did not address Rule 1.7 explicitly.
Do you know why she didn't?
I do not know why.
Because am I correct in assuming that that issue was raised before her?
Well, the conflict of interest issue was raised, and by implication, the 1.7 issue was also implied to be involved in that. The analysis that Judge Stewart goes through addresses those factors, The evidence that she heard also addresses the factual issues that would trigger a 1.7 duty, which is this notion that the trustee is advocating a position that is beneficiary to certain, or beneficial to certain beneficiaries, while detrimental to other beneficiaries. So this notion that the trustees were advocating a position beneficial to one client that harmed another client.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying, in effect, that she addressed the substance of Rule 1.7 without addressing it specifically?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, and the second question I wanted to ask is consideration of Rule 1.7, or was consideration of Rule 1.7 foreclosed to Judge Stewart by the Supreme Court's mention of it, or was it appropriate for Judge Stewart to consider it in light of the Supreme Court's saying, well, no petition for removal had been filed and then one was filed?
I think that in this situation, it was appropriate for Judge Stewart to make that analysis. Remember that this court remanded for further factual findings, an evidentiary hearing. And in Farrell versus Colorado Department of Corrections, it's 179 P3rd 178, the issue of application of the law of the case doctrine after new factual findings occur was addressed. And in this case, what happened was a Colorado Department of Corrections employee was terminated. He argued in an appeal to an administrative board that he was terminated because he had made certain disclosures that were protected under the whistleblower statute. On the basis of the pleadings and the documents that were before this court at that time, the Court of Appeals held that those were protected disclosures under the whistleblower statute as a matter of law. On remand, a trial was held, and after additional evidence was adduced, it was determined that those documents were not protected under the whistleblower statute, and the court in Farrell 2 affirmed the trial court's conclusion, even though there was an argument that that was a conclusion that was law of the case. It's almost exactly the same situation here. We had a situation where the court made a conclusion based on documentary evidence without any additional fact-finding. There was a remand that encompassed a full evidentiary hearing. And after that evidentiary hearing, an understanding of the facts led to a different legal conclusion. I would submit that under those circumstances, it was appropriate for Judge Stewart to reach the conclusion that she did. I think there's another key issue here, which is, at the end of the day, Judge Stewart did comply with this court's mandate. This court ordered the probate court to conduct further proceedings to determine whether the trustee should be removed and an independent trustee appointed for the QTIP trust. Had it been this court's intention that the trustees be removed because, as daughters argue, a conflict of this sort mandates removal, this court is fully capable of drafting a remand that has specific instructions to remove the trustees. It didn't do that. By allowing the court to consider whether removal was necessary, that allowed the court to consider the whole issue.
About the argument that the rule does mandate removal. I mean, it's automatic once the petition for removal has been filed and you have a conflict, you're out of there.
The problem with that argument, from my perspective, Your Honor, is that that compels the conclusion that the law firm trustees were somehow advocating conflicting interests by taking the position that federal law, it's section 2207A of the Internal Revenue Code, required a specific allocation of those estate taxes. If the law is unequivocal that that allocation is required, then going to the court and saying this is what the law requires is not advocating a position that's detrimental to your client. In fact, had they adopted the opposite position and advocated that a different law applied or a different allocation was appropriate, federal law would have imposed penalties on the QTIP trust. So that would have damaged the QTIP every bit as much as simply as the alleged injury that the Q-tip suffers.
Your position basically is that there must be demonstration of an required rather than just some other apparent conflict of interest. And the fact that an apparent conflict would exist doesn't mandate removal.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that before removal is mandated, a lawyer, anyone involved in a situation, needs to look at the full scope of the facts, what the consequences of adopting a position contrary to law would be, and determine whether there is actual advancement of an argument to the detriment of your client. And the mere appearance of an impropriety is no longer the standard. There are additional related issues in how the probate court addressed the mandate. This court, second, instructed the probate court to determine whether to reduce the trustee's compensation or to deny them all compensation. And the law in Colorado was clear that the mere existence of a conflict does not require a denial or reduction of compensation. The probate court, in its analysis, looked at the full scope of how the trustees had acted and had determined that at the end of the day it was inappropriate to reduce or deny compensation. And yet here we are on appeal, that's exactly the remedy that daughters are seeking. The court also addressed the question of whether the trustee should be allowed to exercise the discretion to pay taxes or administrative expenses. And again, it conducted that analysis consistent with the mandate before the court and reached a conclusion that's based on evidence. And under these circumstances, these factual findings after a hearing are entitled to the deference that goes with the fact findings of a trial court. But I want to address one key issue here that I think is critical. Daughters seek to undo. They ask this court to undo everything that has happened so far. They ask this court to essentially award damages against the law firm in the amount of the taxes that were paid by the Q-tip Trust. Now, that payment of taxes by the Q-tip Trust was consistent with federal law. Federal law says that they don't get that amount of money, but they're asking this court to do that. They ask for a reduction or a denial of compensation, and yet the probate court looked at the facts here, looked at how the trustees had acted, and concluded that it was appropriate. They asked this court to award them their attorney's fees, all of the attorney's fees they've incurred to date, and yet the Supreme Court rejected their arguments that they were entitled to an award for attorney's fees in relation to the allocation issues, in relation to everything through the Supreme Court's opinion. They didn't get it the first time, and now they're looking for a second bite at the apple. And it is unfair and unjust to allow them to accomplish that at this point when they have failed on those issues before. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neville. Mr. Forrest, you have just over 5 minutes.
Thank you. On the issue of whether the standard of 1.7 was properly raised, I direct your attention to page 69 of the 2008 transcript in which it was explicitly raised and in which the footnote in footnote 8 of the Supreme Court opinion was directly discussed with Judge Stewart.
But am I correct in saying that Judge Stewart didn't expressly refer to Rule 1.7 in her opinion?
She didn't. She not only didn't expressly refer to it, she did not apply the standards one iota. The standard of a conflict of interest for a lawyer is not based on actual harm. There is actual harm here. But it is based on the risk of harm. 1.7b is very clear on that. She focused exclusively on two things. One thing is the 170 standard, which says they don't have a pecuniary interest in the trust. That's a small subpiece of 1.7, but it's not the rest of 1.7. The rest of 1.7 says if you've got a potential conflict of interest and you don't seek a waiver, there is no dispute that there was never any waiver of conflict of interest secured in this case. You're out.
Mr. Forrest, please tell me what section, what portion of Rule 1.7A you're relying on.
1.7B, Your Honor, if I may.
I know you've mentioned 1.7B, but what portion of 1.7A are you saying creates the conflict here?
The representation of one client will be directly adverse to another, subsection 1, or there's a significant risk that the representation will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client.
What portion of the record would I need to look at to see what evidence you put on as to those subsections?
The entire, we put on evidence in the hearing in 2008, evidence that was sufficient for the judge to actually, for Judge Stewart to actually determine that there was a conflict of interest because there were differing claims between the two trusts and that the lay trustees were conflicted. I think once the court determined that the lay trustees had conflicts of interest between the two trusts because there was a dispute as to the apportionment of fees between the two trusts, they had an obligation to withdraw. And what?
Why does that create a conflict on behalf of the attorneys?
Because they represented both trusts. They provided legal advice.
They being who? Please be specific.
The Katz Law Firm was the lawyer for both trusts. The Katz Law Firm was also a trustee of both trusts. The Katz Law Firm also had an express veto power that they had drafted in conjunction with their client that allowed them to, in fact, control the conflicted clients on both sides of the trust. The Katz Law Firm serving as trustee also had a fiduciary duty that flowed to our clients as beneficiaries of the trust. The Katz Law Firm, and I can give you a record cite on this, never billed for trustee fees. Mr. Katz acknowledged on the record at page 67 of the 2008 hearing that all they ever did was provide legal services to both trusts. So, frankly, the argument that their conduct is governed by the trust standard is a specious one at best. I'll also direct you to comment 9 of RPC 1.7, which acknowledges explicitly that a lawyer may have dual roles in representation and may be simultaneously governed by different standards of conduct. They may be a trustee and owe trustee duties. They may also be a lawyer and owe lawyer duties. That comment makes abundantly clear that the fact that they're wearing a trustee hat one minute and a law firm hat the other minute does not obviate or gut their requirements to comply with Rule 1.7.
Mr. Forrest, what is your response to Mr. Neville's contention that there really was no conflict of interest because the Katz Law Firm was required to interpret the Internal Revenue Code Section 2207 in a particular way?
The problem with that analysis is that both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court acknowledged that the question before them about the apportionment of taxes was a question of first impression. There were four other states that had ruled on the issue. Two had gone one way, two had gone the other. It was a completely new issue. At that point, our client had the right to an independent trustee to be able to advocate the most advantageous position for them. The danger of the argument that they advance and that, frankly, Judge Stewart advances is she uses an ex post facto, post hoc rationalization to get out of the conflict. She doesn't say there's no conflict. There's clearly a conflict of the lay trustees. But she then says, well, at the end, you got what you deserved, so therefore there's no conflict. That is completely contrary to what 1.7 says, because the minute that even a potential conflict arises and you don't have waiver, you're out of the case. What it does is it provides a very dangerous invitation to lawyers who have an unwaived conflict to try to navigate the waters in between their two clients, get to the end of the day and say, gee, I did a pretty good job. Judge Stewart doesn't even say they did a pretty good job. She actually explicitly says in her order, they didn't advance the interests of the other trust.
Excuse me, Mr. Forrest, your time has expired.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Forrest and Mr. Neville, thank you as well for your argument. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.